Come out, Virginia, don't let me wait. You Catholic girls start much too late. All the sooner or later it comes down to fate. I might as well will be the one. Well, they showed you a statue, told you to pray. They built you a temple and locked you away. Ah, but they never told you the price that you pay. The things that you might have done. Only the good die young.
Hello, everyone. This is Dr. Michael Wall, the Blood Detective, and you're listening to Ask the Blood Detective. Today's show is part two of visual signs of disease that you can see in the mirror, and not just when you look at yourself in the mirror, but when you look at other people. Visual clues of disease and dysfunction are right there for you to see. And I got to tell you, a lot of doctors, a lot of healthcare providers miss obvious signs of disease that are literally staring them in the face. And that would be you staring them in the face and them not seeing the problem. So it's up to you to become a bit more familiar with some very, very obvious and more subtle signs of disease that you can see from head to toe on a person. Now, don't worry at all if you missed the first show that I did last week on visual signs of disease, because I'll be incorporating all those concepts today, reinforcing them and expanding upon them. So you're listening again to Ask the Blood Detective. So why are we talking about non-blood things? Well, because if we only spoke about blood, we'd be limiting ourselves to only the blood. And as someone who loves to read and interpret laboratory work, I've even published a 500-page textbook on how to interpret laboratory work from A to Z, medically and nutritionally, in my book called The Anti-Aging Encyclopedia of Laboratory Tests. But I can tell you that a smart practitioner and a smart person, that's you, should be able to look at yourself, look at a person, and put clues together of disease or dysfunction that might occur in the visual field, what you can see, either weeks, months, years, even decades before laboratory work shows problems. So I have sat down with many of you, many of my patients over the years, and some of you are a bit confused as to why you might have had a particular health problem, whether it's cancer, heart disease, autoimmune disease, whatever it might be, and your doctor or healthcare provider has said, well, your laboratory tests are normal. First of all, I need you to accept the fact that laboratory work is abnormal when it is abnormal, meaning when a process in the body, either dysfunction or disease, begins to become more constant. There are various abnormalities or perturbations in our physiology that get to a level that may one day be obvious on blood work, but they also may never show up on blood work. I have had individuals with all manner of disease and have had seemingly perfect laboratory work. Now, before we get into some additional visual signs of disease, let me address what I just said. How is it you can have normal laboratory work and have dysfunction, symptoms, health problems, a loss of quality of life? How is that possible? Well, number one is because your doctor may have not ordered thorough enough laboratory work. So that's the first reason. The second reason is much more common, and it's really important that you hear this. Your blood work might show certain abnormalities and you might have certain health problems, but you might have been told something like this. Well, your laboratory work is essentially normal. I have no explanation for why you have these complaints. That's something your healthcare provider might say. Now, many of you have brought your laboratory work into me and asked me what I thought of it. And it was very apparent and immediate to me that there were signs of problems. How can I see things in the laboratory work that other very good, well-intentioned, intelligent, and caring providers may not have seen? Well, if those healthcare providers are traditionally trained, like traditional physicians, let's say, then they learn to read blood work in a particular way. They have to have a certain amount of abnormality and a certain number of abnormalities on the blood that add up and can be easily categorized into a particular disease condition. So let me say that another way. Let's say you feel you have a sluggish thyroid. That's called hypothyroidism. You have a blood test. It's got your thyroid blood work on there, including a TSH, or a thyroid stimulating hormone. I might look at your blood work after you have been told that everything is normal, and I look at it, and I might see that your TSH is on the high end of the normal range. Now, you hear what I said? High end of the normal range. Your practitioners might look at that and say, well, it's normal. But I might say, well, listen, you have constipation or depression or you're slow healing, you have low body temperature, etc., other signs of hypothyroidism. And your thyroid might be, let's say, 80 or 90% abnormal. But here's what you need to understand. Traditional physicians and practitioners, they don't think in those sorts of percentages. You either have hypothyroidism or you don't until your laboratory work is way out of the range, or just is, is out of the range. It can't be upper end of normal, generally speaking. Now, when I teach lab, I teach the practitioners that are present that one, a good practitioner must always consider the laboratory results in context with the person's symptoms. So if you have signs of hypothyroid and your TSH, for example, is on the high end of normal, yes, I said the high end of normal. In hypothyroidism, the TSH rises and the thyroid hormones on blood work, folks, they may be entirely normal. You know why? They're not that accurate. So my point here is it's important that you're able to look at yourself or look at another person to pick up subtle and not so subtle clues. You know, when you know what to look for in yourself, in the mirror, for example, or in another individual, and you really know about visual signs of disease, nothing's subtle. It just bounces out at you and it's like, boom. Listen, when I walk along the street in my town up here in Westchester and I look at people, sometimes I find myself diagnosing them as I'm walking down the block. I'd say, oh, that individual has a diagonal earlobe crease on their ear. I know they have arterial sclerosis and they have a bit of a pot belly. So that's also associated with cardiovascular disease. And they appear to me that they don't exercise. So those are additive signs. A sign is something you see, right? And that gives me a pretty good idea that something's wrong with that person in the cardiovascular area. It wouldn't be very hard to predict that their cholesterol is high, their triglycerides might be high, they might have hypertension, or maybe they're borderline hypertension, or their cholesterol is borderline. Have you heard that, my friends? Yes, you have. So the more of these signs you put together, the more clearer it is of a dysfunction and or disease that is well on its way. So to be thorough when you're managing your health, you always want, if you do decide to work with a healthcare provider professional, that individual works with you through a detailed consultation about your health issues and also looks at various laboratory tests if appropriate, and they need to look at some of your old laboratory work because there's a lot of those issues I just spoke about, so-called normal findings that are in the upper end of the normal range, but they're still normal, or they're in the lower end of the normal range, but they're still normal, that other practitioners absolutely ignore. So I use a software program, which I designed, called Blood Detective, where I compare over 170 pieces of laboratory work comparing you to average people your age. That is what regular blood work, I've said this on other shows, compares you to, your age-adjusted normal. So if you have normal blood work for someone your age, I don't think you should necessarily jump up and down about that. If you have normal laboratory work relative to someone, let's say 10 or 20 years younger than you, that would be much better. As a 51-year-old man, I do not compare my blood work to other 51-year-old men. I don't want to have normal blood work compared to them. I want to have normal blood work compared to a 20-year-old athlete. And most of my laboratory work is, in fact, in that area because that's what I shot for. So that may or may not be possible for everyone. But if you shoot for that, you're probably going to get a lot further with your health than if you accept not feeling so great or just knowing in your bones that something's just not right and accepting that your lab work is quote unquote normal. So let's talk about some other visual signs of disease and dysfunction. I should say, please listen, that just because you see these signs and symptoms and then you try to look for further evidence upon blood, let's say again that someone has a thick neck. Thick necks are associated with increased risk of cardiovascular disease, but not every time. So if someone has a thick neck, they probably or may have or they might develop at some point in the future sleep apnea, which significantly increases morbidity and mortality from cardiovascular disease. But the blood work may not be abnormal at the same time as you see these symptoms and signs. That shouldn't confuse you. That's just how things happen. So let's talk about some specific visual clues that you're going to want to know. And you're going to start seeing them all over the place. You know, it's just like when you get a new car and you get a model that maybe before you didn't notice, but now you're in this car. And when you're driving along the road, you all of a sudden start to see this car everywhere as if, you know, someone's playing a trick on you or something. Well, all that means, as you can imagine, is that your perception and your ability to recognize something is just more obvious. So it just pops out at you. And after doing this sort of visual exercise for the last at least 27 years of my life in clinical practice, it is so apparent to me most of the time what is happening with a person before I look at their laboratory work. I choose laboratory work to support what I see, not because I'm fishing for straws. You know, laboratory work should be chosen based upon a careful history of your health issues and goals, and also based upon what other testing you've had done. But the laboratory work should reinforce what a practitioner expects to find. It shouldn't be just fishing, like I said. So an individual, by the way, with hypothyroid or low thyroid or just the sluggish metabolism might have dry skin, as I mentioned. They might have a difficult time staying warm. They might feel cold. They might feel tired often. They might feel a bit depressed. They might start to lose their hair on the top of their head, what's known as male pattern baldness, but we see it in women as well. The eyebrows might start to thin and fall out, particularly along the lateral edge. We talked about that during the last show, the lateral edge, the outside edge of the eyebrows. Also, when you're examined by a practitioner and they check your reflexes, like they tap your knee, but particularly when they tap your what's known as your Achilles reflex, that's at the foot, that reflex has a delayed, what they call recoil. It's just slower. That is a very, very hard sign, what they call a hard sign for hypothyroidism. A person certainly might have a thick neck because they have an enlarged thyroid. Quite often, I will see individuals that come to see me and they say, for years, I've been trying to find answers to my problem. And I'm looking at them and I'm thinking, well, you know, their right eye is bulging. And I say, so what's going on with your right eye? And they'll say, what do you mean? I always looked like this. But bulging eyes, along with other symptoms, I should say signs, like those I've just mentioned, are very, very suggestive of hypothyroidism. When the thyroid gland slows down, the tissues behind the eye start to grow. That's known as proliferate. And they push the eye out. It's called exophthalmos. That's a very clear sign of hypothyroid, and blood work may not show it. In fact, it's been estimated that you'd have to lose about 40% of your thyroid function before your blood tests show anything wrong. And you know something? What that means is the blood ranges for thyroid tests, they're too wide. By the time there's an abnormality that shows, you've really got disease. That's why I've designed my blood detective interpretation software to look for about 25% loss of function. I don't wait until it's 40, 30, 40, 50%, which the regular tests do. Another early sign or sign of hypothyroidism that is present now is if you can't walk very far, you just lose your breath. That is often a sign of underactive thyroidism. Some people particularly who can't even manage just a slight incline, they just get out of breath. People who go to the gym because they think they're unfit, but actually it's because they're unwell. And I see these people working out and they just don't make any gains. So if you don't notice any improvement in your fitness after trying, you might very well have a thyroid problem. And by the way, if you happen to have a family history, you know, a family member who has a thyroid problem, there's a pretty good chance you're going to get it too. Now, folks, please hear me here. Before you have either a visual symptom, something you could see, and before you have blood work showing an abnormality, a disease, you don't. Meaning, there are subtle changes that occur, as I said earlier, over a long period of time. So if we put these all together, the smart blood detective, and that's you, can figure these things out and start working on them with natural therapies. And if you think you have a low thyroid, for example, you might have an iron deficiency, you might need iodine. But by the way, don't load yourself up with iodine like I see so many people doing. That could actually cause thyroiditis. You have to be very, very careful. It's particularly important as far as the diet goes for vegetarians to be aware of what I'm saying here, because they're not getting their iron from red meat. If you have iron deficiency, that's called an iron anemia. If you have an iron anemia, you're going to have a slow metabolic rate. You're going to feel cold. Your skin might be white. You might have some blue tinge to your skin, particularly in your fingernails and your toes. And on the other hand, by the way, a hyperactive thyroid would make you feel excessively hot or sweaty. So you can see how if you put together some symptoms, that's things you feel like sweaty, let's say, or jittery, those are signs of hyper, that means high thyroid. And if you simply can't eat enough and you feel like you got a tapeworm, that could be hyperthyroid as well. Throw in a little osteopenia or osteoporosis in there, and that substantiates hyperthyroidism in the context of those symptoms I just mentioned. I personally believe that not all cases, by the way, of hypothyroidism require medication. I have had patients that through dietary interventions, they have entirely resolved their hypothyroidism. Now, hyperthyroidism, in my experience, in my opinion, is a lot harder to resolve nutritionally, but that doesn't mean it does not respond. There are many nutritional implications to hyperthyroidism. That's the high one. Usually an increased need for a variety of nutrients exponentially. And hypothyroidism and low thyroid, you also may need lots of nutrients. For example, one needs vitamin D to produce thyroid hormones. One needs zinc, iodine, iron, B-complex, fatty acids. Now, just because you may take those things does not mean you're taking the right doses. In fact, and this I'm directing to every single listener out there, if you are taking nutritional supplements and you have not based their dosing, you know, the amount of milligrams or grams of whatever it is you're taking, on your metabolic rate, you are missing the boat by a long shot. You wouldn't think that someone who's 200 pounds would need the same nutritional dosing as someone who weighs what you weigh, or lighter or heavier. Metabolic rate is a key factor that determines the right dose of supplementation. And of course, if someone does have a low thyroid, they need to exercise. But they need to exercise in a way that they can successfully do that. But if you do begin exercising, guess what? Your nutrition changes again to deal with the increased need of the exercise. If you look at your nails, those with hypothyroidism will tend to have thin nails. They may be slightly yellowed. They may crack. You might also have white spots in your nails. Your nails may also grow very slowly. Your hair might be on the thin side, and or you may have bald spots in your hair or thinning spots. Why don't we move to something completely different? What about infections? What could you see on yourself in the mirror or looking at another person that might mean they have infections? They might have a swollen neck due to swollen lymph nodes. And then, of course, if the doctor palpates or touches these areas, the lymph nodes would be swollen. But sometimes you can just see them, just like you can see a swollen thyroid gland when it gets to a certain degree of being affected in a person. Another thing you might see on a person who has chronic infection would be weight loss. They get thin. They might have symptoms like a cough or shortness of breath. They certainly might have diarrhea and, of course, a fever. Now, this is an important area of health that you can work on by looking at different people and practicing this. And it has to do with figuring out how the nervous system is working. Now, the nervous system, as you might imagine, controls absolutely every single function in the body. Now, a very common sign, something that I can see on a person, something that you can see on yourself or someone else, that means that they have a nervous system problem, specifically in a part of the nervous system that's called the autonomic nervous system, is when they complain of pain or numbness in their fingers or toes. Usually it's both hands, and sometimes it can also be both toes. Now, what that may be is something called Raynaud's disease or Raynaud's phenomenon. And basically, just to simplify things for this conversation, that condition involves a nervous system that is nervous. There's two parts of the autonomic nervous system. And as the name suggests, the autonomic nervous system does things automatically without much conscious thought. Now, that doesn't mean your conscious thought can't affect the autonomic nervous system. It certainly can. But in Raynaud's disease and Raynaud's phenomenon, what happens is when a person is in the cold, the nervous system hyperreacts because it's anxious, it's hypersensitive. When that person grips something cold or just grips something for long periods of time or has emotional stress, the small blood vessels, the capillaries they're called, in the fingers and or the toes, it doesn't have to be both, and sometimes it might only be a finger or two, but it's something that tends to recur with people, and usually during the winter, but not always. When that person is exposed to physical stress on the hands or emotional stress or gripping or cold, there is a hyper-responsiveness and the tiny blood vessels constrict. Now, what do you think would happen if blood vessels constrict? Well, you'd have reduced blood flow, right? And then the fingertips or the toes might appear white and or bluish because of the lack of the oxygenated blood. Another sign that would reinforce the fact that a person has autonomic nervous system dysfunction, and by the way, one could focus lifestyle, including, of course, a stress reduction, coping skills, and also nutritional supplementation and foods towards reducing the hyper-responsiveness of the sympathetic nervous system that causes the constriction, which, as I said, causes either white and or bluish nail beds and fingertips. Just so you know, a DHA oil, something that I provide in my company, Blood Detective, is an omega-3 fatty acid that has been shown in double-blind, placebo-controlled studies to improve Raynaud's disease. One of the reasons is not just because DHA is anti-inflammatory, but because DHA oil actually it's a major component of the physical nervous system itself. In addition, Omega-3 fats, like DHA, reduce what's known as blood viscosity or blood thickness, meaning that DHA improves blood flow, which would help these symptoms of Raynaud's disease. Now, if this individual with this symptom tends to be pretty high strung, or they tend to hyper-respond to stress, that reinforces the fact that this is probably Raynaud's. Now, I will tell you that there are a number of people that I see this problem with, and I'm observing them, I'm talking with them. They might have racing thoughts. They seem to be fairly intense, very self-directed. There are certain personality types, like the type A higher intensity personality, which tends to get conditions like Raynaud's. The same type A stress type personalities, and that may be you, a lot of people do not recognize the personality types that they are by themselves. You know, in the first show, I quoted Plato. Let's see if I can get this right. I'm going to paraphrase. He said something like, look not at the disease a person has, but the person that has the disease. So personality types that tend to hold on to things and they don't express their stress, they tend to get lymphoma. Individuals that are very high strung, the type A personality, they tend to get more heart attacks. But those with the type A personalities that tend to get more heart attacks, they also statistically seem to survive more of them as well because of their attitudes. And by the way, as a side note, if you ever think that you're having a heart attack, you want to cough as vigorously as you can, because coughing vigorously actually compresses the chest and massages the heart and helps the blood flow. It's almost like CPR, but you're doing it yourself. Other signs of nervous system dysfunction, which might look just like hypothyroidism, low thyroid, is feeling of cold, pins and needles sometimes, sensations in the hands or in the legs, and either a constipation or having too many bowel movements in a day. If you have two or more bowel movements a day, you almost certainly have a hypersympathetic nervous system. And the problem with that system is this. Any system in your body that overworks for too long breaks down. So general nutritional support, by the way, for the autonomic nervous system in general would be DHA oil, CoQ10, but in the form of the active CoQ10, which is ubiquinol. That's about 8 times more potent than ubiquinone. Vitamin E, all in the natural alpha-tocopherol forms. And L-carnitine with lipoic acid. These are some of the key ones, but also certain amino acids like arginine and citrulline, which are in my amino acid complex and my cardio complex products. So these types of things should be dosed based on metabolic rate, or at least some consideration of your overall weight should be included in figuring out dosing. And what about signs of hormonal imbalances? Well, certainly dry skin, excessive wrinkling that may be disproportionate to your age, loss of turgor to the skin. If you touch the skin and you pull on the skin and you pull it towards you and let it go, it has a delayed recoil. It's very slow to take back its flat shape. Let's say on the top of the hand, if you were to pull the skin up. I want you to do that now and then hold it up for about 3 seconds and let it go. And if you can still see that line where your fingers were squeezing the skin, and it really fades before your eyes, well, that means you've lost skin turgor. It's less flexible. And by the way, when skin is less flexible, generally arteries are also less flexible. Let me jump around a little bit. What about signs of liver dysfunction? Well, the first thing sign that you might see on a person with significant liver dysfunction is that their skin may be yellow. Not only will their skin be a bit yellow, it might have a very faint yellow hue to it that a person might even say, yeah, no, I've always had the skin color, but they may not have. They may have had it for years, but it may have been subtle and then a bit more obvious where someone could notice it. But a lot of the times, people have these changes like change in skin color, which in liver dysfunction would be a bit yellow, that is so subtle that even their family members and friends never notice it. And they're like, oh, yeah, that's just what he looks like. But that's generally thought to be the accumulation of bilirubin in the skin, which is fat soluble, so it stays in the skin. Now, if that is particularly advanced, the liver dysfunction, a person would also have yellowing of the white area of their eyes, and that's called icterus. Now, if you make lots of vegetable juices that contain carrots, the carrots will cause, eventually in some people, their skin to look like it has high bilirubin. It'll look yellow. But the whites of the eyes with carrot juice will never get yellow. That's an important distinguishing characteristic. And there are doctors who don't understand juicing, and they don't understand that carrots can do that, and they can put people through a battery of dangerous and expensive tests for no reason. On the other hand, I have had people that have sat before me that I've worked with that were somehow aware of how carrots and the beta carotene in the carrots can deposit in the skin, and they thought that their yellow skin was from their juicing, but they really did have liver dysfunction. And upon blood work, that individual that has yellow eyes and yellow skin, or one or the other, may certainly have elevation of one or more liver enzymes. Now, this isn't a sign, something that you see, but a person might feel nauseous. They may get full easily. They may tire easily. There are all sorts of other symptoms of liver dysfunction. That depends on the cause of the liver dysfunction, the extent of it. But in general, the skin changes, as I mentioned, but also it might just be the forehead might get a little yellow. One particularly good sign of bilirubin accumulation from liver dysfunction is when you have a person, say, stick out your tongue and you lift their tongue up, if it's yellow underneath the tongue, or when they say, ah, the top of their mouth is yellow. Now, some of you are thinking, well, what about if I have a pasty tongue, a white coating, or a yellowish coating? Well, that could be from any number of health problems, including simple dehydration, by the way. It doesn't always mean, for some of you thinking this, that you have a candida infection or oral thrush of your mouth. Lots of natural healthcare providers go right to that, and some of the times they just may not be aware of some of the basic medical reasons for that change in the tongue. So they attribute, you know, every change in the tongue to candida. But sometimes it actually is from candida. So the tongue with candida will look like a thick white or cream-colored deposit over the tongue. And that is what oral thrush is, which is a type of candida fungus. And the tongue can be sore or it can be painful. It can bleed, particularly when it's scraped. And also the oral thrush, the candida, can also spread to the roof of the mouth and even the back of the throat. And commonly, people with oral thrush or any persistent fungal infection, by the way, whether it's sinusitis, most sinusitis is actually fungal, not bacteria. And also there's vaginosis that can be fungal, may have hyperglycemia, high blood sugar, or diabetes. So a person that keeps getting, let's say, urinary tract infections, sinus infections, they need to have their blood sugar checked. But their hemoglobin A1C blood sugar is what they need checked. I'm going to say that again. Hemoglobin A1C. Hemoglobin A1C is a several-week average of blood glucose. if the practitioner takes glucose on the day you come in, that's only your glucose on that day, and it might be fine. And it might miss that over the course of several months, you've run on the high end of blood sugar, and blood sugar tends to act as a fuel to feed fungal organisms. Now, I should say that not all forms of sugar cause fungal overgrowth. I'll direct you to the show that I had done several weeks ago called Sugar, the Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. Sugar, the Good, and the Bad, and the Ugly. I dispel lots of myths around sugar and the different types of sugar. So let's just take a step back for a second, and I'm going to throw a couple of different signs and symptoms at you. And I want you to notice how, as I mention each one, how it starts to form a pattern that might make you think of a certain disease. So if someone comes to me and they say they have poor appetite, I'll of course discuss their eating patterns. But one of the questions that I'm going to ask them is, what about your weight? Have you lost weight without trying recently? And if they have lost weight without trying, that is very suspicious, usually for cancer. Doesn't always mean that. Then I'll ask them, among other things, do you have any abdominal pain? Do you have any belly pain? That's another sign, I'm sure, or symptom. The patient tells me they have pain. That's something they're telling me, so that is a symptom. Then they might say that they feel full very easily after eating even small meals. They might have reflux, which is heartburn or indigestion. They might get nauseous very easily. So you can. And by the way, you know, people that have intestinal cancers, they tend to have thickening of their fingertips. And that may have to do with the buildup of certain tissues from circulation issues. And no one really knows exactly why that happens. I did explain a little bit more in the first show, but you'll see that the area around the fingernails, at the tip of the fingers, gets thick. They call that clubbed fingertips. Let's talk about adrenal gland dysfunction, because most people listening to this show know about the adrenal glands. So we have two adrenal glands. If you look at your hands and make a fist with both hands, your kidneys are about the size of your fist, and your adrenal glands are about the size of your thumb, and they're perched right on top of your adrenals, just like they are on top of your hand. And there's different parts of the adrenal glands. We won't get into those, meaning a cortex and a medulla, and these parts of the adrenals produce different hormones. But I see people often that believe they have low adrenal function. Now, the first thing to realize with low adrenal function is what people tend to mean, what low adrenal function is in natural healthcare circles, is often very different than what it means in traditional medical circles. So, for example, there's a condition in medicine known as Addison's disease, and Addison's disease is an extreme, it is the extreme form or the form of hypoadrenalism. Hypo is low and hyper is high. So I'm going to start introducing, in addition to the signs, the visual things we see, some symptoms as well. Now, before I do that though, I want to finish completing the difference between how traditional medicine diagnoses and acknowledges the presence of low adrenal function or Addison's disease and how it differs from what natural healthcare providers in general tend to think. Now, I will tell you this. Most of the time when a person is told in natural healthcare, natural medicine, that they have low adrenal function, they do not have low adrenal function based on the criteria of traditional medicine. There are specific factors that must show up. And by the way, folks, it goes far beyond just having a low saliva cortisol and or a low saliva or salivary DHEA. Now, for those of you who don't know what the heck I'm talking about, I'm really appealing to those out there who have had these expensive and fairly useless saliva tests for the adrenal glands done. And some of you are thinking, what do you mean useless? I did it and it showed my cortisol was low. If you have low adrenal function in the natural healthcare sense, meaning it's not as horrific as that in medicine, because that is usually what the case is, you may or may not have low cortisol. You could have normal cortisol and your body might not use it. Then what do you do with the saliva test? It says it's normal. It could even say it's high. And it could be normal or high, listen up, because your cells and tissues are resistant to it. So think about it. If your brain is, your brain has brain cells, neurons, and the neurons have receptors for cortisol on them. And if for whatever reason your brain or whatever other tissue in your body's receptors become old and insensitive or desensitized, they would not read the cortisol that's circulating in the blood, which is right at the receptor site. So let me say it more directly. If your tissues are losing sensitivity to cortisol, your body, your adrenals, will usually make more cortisol to force it in, to just keep you even. So the blood or the saliva might show high cortisol, but you might actually suffer from low cortisol symptoms because the cells aren't taking it in. And because your cells may not be taking it in, your body increases it, and maybe initially you get a bit of a jolt. Maybe it lasts a week, maybe it lasts a month, maybe a few years. But then your adrenals cannot produce that much cortisol anymore. So the cortisol levels start to come down to normal, right? But you're feeling all of the signs of low adrenal function. You might have weight loss. You might be very weak. You might have extreme fatigue. You could have frequent nausea. Your blood pressure may be on the low end, okay? That's when we use something like a liquid, licorice, because licorice is a very nice modifier of adrenal function. It helps the adrenals recover, unlike caffeine, which hyperstimulates and wears down, further reducing adrenal function. And by the way, it's not any amount of caffeine, but you know, if you're having two or more cups a day, that could, in a susceptible person, weaken the adrenals even further. Your skin, here's a sign you might see. You might have patches of darker skin, okay? And that has to do, we think, with the deposition in the skin of something called adrenochrome. You might crave salt. In fact, all of this salt restriction is acknowledged now in traditional medicine to be a cause of fatigue. So again, we just take things to extremes. And another sign of low adrenal function, both, by the way, in traditional medicine and alternative medicine, might be dizziness when you stand up. A lot of people experience this. Now, that's called a vasovagal response. What that means is when you stand up fast, your adrenal glands, your cardiovascular system, your autonomic nervous system, all of those three things and more, have to respond to the stress of going from sitting to standing. And if the neurohormonal signals to the blood vessels that bring blood to your head are just not there because the adrenals are fatigued, then when you stand up, either normally or too fast for you, because you're lightheaded, that could be a sign of hypoadrenalism, another way of saying low adrenals. Now, many patients that I have suggested that they have sluggish or hypoadrenal function, some of them go running off to their regular physicians, and then they say, my doctor said I don't have Addison's disease. I said, I never said you had Addison's disease. I distinguish that there's a disease called Addison's disease, which is the worst level of hypoadrenalism you can get, but you have some percentage of that. So there is a distinction, very, very different criteria for a differential diagnosis, it's called, figuring out what things are. Particularly if a healthcare provider, a natural healthcare, is not trained in traditional medicine. You know, I went to chiropractic college and I learned a certain amount of of anatomy and neurology and endocrinology and pharmacology and all this kind of stuff, and ways of thinking about the body in specific ways, learning the very same physiology, neuroanatomy, histology, all that stuff that any physician, any medical doctor would learn, except they learn it in a context of a different philosophy. So when a physician looks at you as opposed to, let's say, a chiropractor or a very well-trained clinical nutritionist or a nurse practitioner or whatever, or an acupuncturist, you the list goes on and on, you get different information. So I make it my business to gather as much knowledge from as many different areas of healthcare as I can. So that's why I went to chiropractic college. Then I got my master's in nutrition. Then I got alternative nutritional degrees. But then I got my traditional dietitian's license and also my license as a certified nutrition specialist. I completed medical school. So these are examples of things that I personally felt that I needed to do so that when I look at someone, when I deal with someone's health issues and health goals, I just see more stuff. I see a lot more stuff. And what is unfortunate is that most in the general public really cannot distinguish between different levels of healthcare providers. Certainly someone who, this is a generalization, this is not always true, but sometimes if an individual gets a degree, let's say a nutrition degree online, and they've never seen patients during the course of that degree, how can they possibly know how to look at patients if they do not learn how to take a appropriate health history, and they only learn 50 different diets? I mean, these are limitations. I think there's value in all of it. That's why, personally, I make it my business to learn as much as I can from a variety of areas. I appreciate traditional medicine very much, and I appreciate what is called alternative or holistic medicine. I like to call it complementary healthcare, because I think the term complement is just semantically more accurate. But anyway, I would encourage you to learn a little bit about your blood work. Learn how it's read medically a little bit. Know what an iron anemia looks like. And by the way, an iron anemia doesn't mean that you have anemia simply because your serum iron is low. That doesn't do it. That's not what constitutes iron anemia. Most people think that. It's your hemoglobin and or your hematocrit on your blood tests are low. And it would be further supported, a long-term iron anemia, by the way, by a low or abnormal ferritin. If a person, there's a few examples of some lab tests. If a person has osteoporosis, let me ask you a question. Is their blood calcium going to be low? The answer is no. Almost never is that the case. So physicians don't make the diagnosis of osteopenia or osteoporosis based on blood calcium, because the body keeps the calcium level in a very, very, very tight range in extreme health problems. But on the other hand, if your calcium level is elevated, well, that could mean that the lab test was just done wrong, or you're dehydrated and your calcium is concentrated and it looks high in the blood, but it's really not, although it can cause problems, definitely. Or elevated calcium could mean that you have what's called hyperparathyroidism. And that condition tends to predispose to breast cancer, because that high calcium accumulates in the breast, and people get those calcium-laden breast cysts, which is also associated with bone loss, right? Why? Because the calcium has to come out of the bones. And also there's more heart disease. Well, why is that? And hypertension. Well, because the calcium deposits in the arteries and it gets hard, and that increases the blood pressure. Also, a person might have stiff joints. Well, why would that be? Well, because the high calcium causes some calcium deposits or calcium deposition, as it's called, in the joint spaces, causing arthritis and stiff joints or painful joints. A person might have all kinds of neurologic issues, from fatigue to headaches, yes, those are neurologic issues from problems with calcium. Now, what about blood sugar? What would you see on a person who has blood sugar issues? Well, a person might simply be pale. Pale because their blood sugar is too high, or they might also be pale because their blood sugar is too low as well. So either high or low blood sugar can cause what's called pallor. A person might also feel jittery or shaky. They might be quick to become irritable, or they might fatigue easily. They might shake, get cold, start to sweat. These could be signs, and commonly are, of hypoglycemia, low blood sugar, but also high blood sugar can also cause those problems. I cannot tell you how many people will come to see me and they will say, oh yes, I ate food and soon after I felt jittery and shaky, my mouth got real dry, I started to sweat, I know I have hypoglycemia. And then we look at their lab work and they actually have diabetes. So don't assume that just because you think your symptoms match some textbook, that you're actually a textbook. The thing about being your own personal blood detective is you need to write the book on yourself. How do you do that? What does that even mean? Well, for example, I mentioned earlier that I did, in fact, write a book, and I'm holding it in my hands right now, sending it out to a doctor tomorrow who wanted a copy. It's called The Anti-Aging Encyclopedia of Tests and Natural Treatments, right? It's a 500-page book. Now, you could look up in that book all of your blood work, and you can get a pretty good idea of what some of it means. But what you're not going to get in a book is putting it all together in a way that, let's say, a computer program like Blood Detective could, or that an astute person like the person you are really becoming now, when you look at visual signs of disease and putting it all together, can really do. So books and what we call protocols, you know, you look up everything from endometriosis to herpes zoster to headaches in some textbook of natural medicine. It tells you what to do. But most of that is ridiculous because you can have those health problems and others because of very, very different reasons than the next person. So how do you deal with this? Well, like I keep saying, you need to see a practitioner or work with someone or complete your own thorough metabolic screening questionnaires that look at all areas of the body. That helps you orient yourself somewhat. Then you do certain laboratory work that looks at all body systems. Why? Because the whole body works together. So why would you want to neglect any body system? That's the problem when we see specialists. Specialists seem to think that their specialty is all there is. And then even those that acknowledge, well, of course that's not true, although that they work as if it is, they don't really communicate with other practitioners. And what does that happen? Where does that leave you? Well, that leaves you seeing practitioner after practitioner, wondering why they're not getting it, and no one's talking, and it's just a mess. So I think that the healthcare of the future, which really does exist now, has to do with simply this. You should be figured out your health issues and building of your health relative to yourself over time. Things need to be tried, and let's face it, most of us listening to the show have a bias for natural healthcare. You try things, you don't just judge if a thing works based on how you feel. You can feel better spontaneously, or you might feel better just for a very short period of time. And if you don't know what I'm talking about, think of whether or not you have tried to figure out how a food or a nutritional supplement is affecting you, and it just gets really complicated. Many people actually believe that when they take a supplement, you know, in like 5 minutes or 2 hours later, you know, they're affected by it. That's almost never true. But, you know, the mind really does play on the physical body. There's no doubt about that. It's one thing. But I prefer a more even approach and balanced approach, which means we look at visual signs, we do thorough metabolic screening questionnaires, The laboratory and testing is based on health goals, and it's based on what testing has been done in the past, if there's any, and it's based on what those visual signs and all of the symptoms that you have tell us it means. Then we design as natural healthcare plans as we can. And for those of you who believe that at some point, when you've tried all the natural things you can, that traditional medicine might be of help, then you'd use that. I think I'll end today, though, by talking a little bit about skin cancers, because you can obviously see those. And I've seen people come in with skin cancers known as melanomas, and they've put like hydrogen peroxide on the melanoma, and they've made the melanoma, which is normally dark, much lighter, and they think that's actually helping the cancer, but all it is causing it to be lighter. So, you know, we need to be careful about these things. So what we need to know when we're dealing with skin cancer, particularly we're talking about melanoma right now, is that first of all, melanomas can, they're all skin cancers, but they can start in the eye, they can start in the intestines, in the vaginal tissue, or any other areas of the body that have pigments. Now, often the first sign of a melanoma is a change in the shape, the color, the size, or the feel of a mole that a person might have. But melanomas can also appear as like a brand new mole that you never had growing on your skin. So you should definitely tell your doctor if you notice any sorts of skin changes like this. So the only way to definitively diagnose a melanoma is you got to remove it, and you have to do a histological report on it. You have to check it for cancer cells. But you want to think in terms of what's called, this is the acronym. It's called ABCDE. A for asymmetry. So the shape of one half of the mole does not match the other half. Then B is for border, a border that is irregular. The edges of the mole, they're often ragged, they're notched in, they're blurred, in outline, and they tend to spread and then blur themselves into surrounding tissue. And then there is C in the ABCDE. The C is for color. The color's uneven. There's different shades of black and brown. Some tan might be present. There even could be areas of white, pink, gray, or even blue. And then the D in the ABCD acronym is the diameter. So there's a change in the size. Usually there's an increase in size. Melanomas can be tiny, but most are larger than the size of a pea. So that's, that's like a fourth of an inch. That's pretty big. And I've seen people come in with these things and they don't know what they are. And then the E in the ABCDE acronym is evolving. The mole has changed over the past several weeks or months. I do not believe that nutrition should be the primary therapy for malignant melanoma. If that melanoma can be removed, it should be removed. Think of it this way. If you can remove it surgically, often it's very minor in-office procedures. You've debulked it. You've removed a ton of the cancer. And then your natural nutrition and diet, which we, of course, could go into for 2 hours, should be done. So, and by the way, there's another type of skin cancer known as squamous cell carcinomas, and they tend to appear as flat, reddish-brown patches in the skin, often with a very scaly or crusted surface to them. They're a bit rough, and they tend to grow very slowly. And you'll find them mostly on sun-exposed areas of the body, like, the ears, the face, the neck, the lips, the back of the hands, the top of the head. And then there's another very common type of skin cancer. Again, we're talking about signs, things you can see on people at first. Well, first of all, it's called a basal cell carcinoma. When they first appear, they tend to come up like a small sort of pearly bump that looks like a flesh-colored mole or a pimple that just does not go away. Sometimes these basal cell growths, they can look dark. They can also appear a bit shiny pink or red patches that are slightly scaly. Another very common appearance that you should watch out for is a waxy, hard skin growth. So those are the three most common types of skin cancers. And I hope that through this conversation and the last conversation on visual signs of disease, so we added some symptoms and signs, we talked about philosophy of healing a bit. I hope you can put some of this together as you listen to the different Ask the Blood Detective shows, because as you know, as many of you have been telling me, they're like universities, these shows that I'm doing. I'm trying to give you every bit of gold. So for those who would like to speak with me or become a patient of mine, you can call me. You can call me at 914-242-8844. I practice in Westchester County. That's an hour north of New York City. But I really want to know your ideas and concepts for upcoming shows. So that's how I get all of these topics from you. So I really appreciate it. Now, the next show, this one you have got to hear. This is called Everything About Enzymes. You think that enzymes are about just digestion and anti-inflammation? You have got to listen to this show. I am squeezing into an hour in very practical format every practical thing that you should know about the use of enzymes to maintain your health and to prevent disease. So thanks for joining me today. My name is Dr. Wald. Please go to my website. Tell me your concepts. Tell me your show ideas. The website is www.integratednutritionny.com. You can email me at info@blooddetective.com and for supplements at Blood Detective website. Thanks very much. We'll talk to you soon. Done.